is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Let me take a moment to let everyone know about the upcoming BTS Summit in St. Louis on September 27th and 28th. If you haven't heard, BTS is a comprehensive program for running a long-term, profitable, high-quality youth basketball training company. It allows someone to have a career in youth basketball, helping young people become the best they can be both on and off the court. I am honored to have Larry Hughes, 13-year NBA veteran and a co-founder of BTS, here to tell us what this summit is all about. Larry, tell us about the upcoming summit and what it's all about.
Mike, thanks and congratulations on your Hoop Heads podcast. We established the summit to provide people interested in building a successful youth basketball program the opportunity to come in for 2 days of learning what we do, how we do it, and how they can apply our system to grow their programs. In March, I opened up our 16,000 square foot facility with leading technology used by several NBA teams, which tracks every shot, every movement on the court, allowing us to objectively assess the progress of our members. People who join the summit will get a chance to use the technology and learn how we integrate it into our programs. We will have David Martin, recently head analytics of the 76ers, speak about direction of technology in basketball. We will also have presentations and workshops on how to effectively build back office systems to create memorable experiences for members and build long-term value in the business. We want to empower the attendees to take their basketball organizations to the next level. So the first 30 signups get to participate for free. Thereafter, it's $199 per person. We have arranged discounted hotels in the area. The event also offers the opportunity to network with others in similar circumstances. We're excited to provide this opportunity to market and think that all attendees will get extraordinary value for attending.
Larry, the summit sounds great. Where can people go to learn more and get signed up?
They can go to basketballtrainingsystems.com/summit to learn more or call us at 301-602-3001.
Thanks, Larry. I'm hoping to make it out to St. Louis myself.
Everyone faces the same challenge, you know, the challenge of being in a journey of self-improvement, and you have to fall in love with boredom. You get bored. Sometimes you play basketball and you work out, you get bored. I mean, it's just reps and going through the same stuff over and over again. And sometimes it's just boring. I mean, even if you are the guy that loves basketball the most.
Oscar Yebra played 20 seasons of professional basketball, mostly in Spain, but he also played in France and Iran. Oscar played in the 2004 Olympic Games in Athens as a member of the Spanish national team that included numerous NBA players, including Pau Gasol, Jose Calderon, and Rudy Fernandez. Oscar played in 431 ACB games, the Spanish First Division, with almost 10,000 minutes played in his career. Oscar also has a wide array of coaching accomplishments on his resume, including head men's basketball coach at South China University of Technology, international scout and consultant for FIBA, the NCAA, and the NBA, skill development workouts at all levels from mini-basket to pro players in different countries, camp curriculum development, and he is also the founder, owner, and head coach at Elite Dalian Basketball Club in China. Oscar currently lives and works in China, where he's enjoying new challenges and opportunities in the world of coaching and sports business. If you like what you hear on the Hoopheads podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to our show. Thank you for being a part of Hoopheads Nation. As we grow the Hoopheads pod, please help support the cause by sharing our show with your friends in the coaching profession. We feel there's no better podcast out there to help you grow as a coach in a format that is both entertaining and informative. Visit our website, hoopheadspod.com, to see every episode we've ever recorded. Please hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode. You're going to enjoy this conversation with Oscar Yebra, former Spanish professional basketball player and current international basketball coach and scout from all the way across the globe in China. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome all the way from China, Oscar Yebra, coach, scout, longtime professional basketball player. Oscar, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me on. Excited to be here.
Absolutely. We are excited to be able to talk to you about the wide range of diverse things that you've been able to do in the game of basketball. And we're going to start by going back to when you were a young kid and how you got introduced to the game of basketball
and what made you fall in love with the game that has sort of become your life's passion?
Well, I should say that I was not introduced to the game of basketball. I was forced to the game of basketball by my two older brothers. I was playing soccer like football, Spanish football or European football, like many or most of the kids in Spain. We all play football since we can walk.
What team's your team?
I'm a Madrid fan. Good. I'm not Chris.
We're on the same page there. I like you.
I'm not crazy about it. I have to say, I don't know if it's because I play professional sports or because I'm also working scouting teams and players for a long time already. Every time I watch a game, it's not fresh anymore. It's everything is analytic, and I don't enjoy sports when I watch the games like before, except if it's a very, very special occasion. So I still enjoy watching Real Madrid, and I rather Real Madrid over Barcelona, but just not as crazy as other people about that.
Understood.
So I was playing football, and by the age of eight, I started to grow up a lot, and my brothers, the two brothers, they went to talk to my parents, and they just forced me into basketball. And I was crying for like a week. I didn't want to start playing football with my friends, and I didn't want to quit that team. I was very happy there, and I was doing pretty good. But they just forced me into basketball, I have to say.
Were your brothers basketball players, or they just wanted to force you to play because you were tall?
No, they were playing basketball. I mean, they were playing basketball. They were playing pretty good. I mean, they never played professionally, but they were playing pretty good at the local level. And I really enjoy watching them play. You know, in Spain, we play in the streets all the time. Back in my days, we were in the streets playing all kind of sports. And I remember summertime, you know, waiting for my mom to light the bulbs and calling me from all the way across the neighborhood to let me know the dinner was ready. Because we were playing whatever it was, the sport, depending on if the field was empty or not, it depended if we had one ball or another ball. And I started to play basketball in my school. First year was a nightmare. We lost every game, not less of about 80 points, 90 points. It was crazy. But then I started to have the grasp of it and enjoy it more and more and more. And that was the beginning of a very, very long career and a huge love for basketball that even today is a very big part of my life.
So as you started to get into the game, because at first, obviously, you were upset and wanted to continue to play soccer and basketball was new to you. But as you started to play a lot more and understand it better, what was it about the game that you really enjoyed? Was there one specific part of it? Was there just the competitiveness? What was it about basketball that once you had been exposed to it, that really made you say, hey, I could do something with this game?
It's a very interesting question. The first thing that I loved about basketball was the pace, going up and down so quickly, and everyone having the chance of being involved in the game. That got me hooked up on the game. Because I remember playing football, and sometimes you were there if you were playing on defense, you could be there for 10 minutes and not even have been touching the ball. And when you were playing basketball up and down all the time, having the chance of touching the ball and creating associations with people, you know, it was just fun, really, really exciting. And then by the time that I started to play a little better and better and better, I feel more and more comfortable. You know, I always thought that, and that was very important for my family, every time we talk about sports or any other aspect of life, it was about setting intentions and not setting goals. So my goal was not to be a very good basketball player. My goal was to have a clear intention of being a little better every day. And by being a little better every day, we were talking about doing my best every single time that I was in a basketball court, no matter if it was an organized session with my coach or in my teammates, or if I was playing with some friends, pickup games, or if I was playing with my brothers, because no doubt one of the best things that happened in my life when I was in youth development as a kid was playing with my brothers and their friends. Even though they were killing me and they pushed me and they grabbed me and I was very skinny at the time and you know they were really bullying me, but that was incredibly good for me and my game to raise the competitive level and the toughness of my game. So The moment where I realized that I could make a living playing basketball was a lot later, about when I was 16 years old. I was recruited by one of the most important teams in Spain, Badalona. My hometown, León, was a very small city with a pretty decent reputation in basketball, especially in school basketball. My school in León, we were competing with professional clubs every time we were playing the local and national championships. But when I was recruited to Badalona, I have to travel all the way to Barcelona. That moment was the first time that I realized, okay, I can probably make this work. Because in my life, every time there is a common pattern is I just need an opportunity. I was very, very confident. I always very confident about my work. So if I have the opportunity, I'm already happy because I know my work and my effort is going to speak up for me. I don't need to explain anything else, and I don't need any more things that just open the door for me, allow me to get my foot on the door, and from there I'll be okay.
So describe the process from when your brothers get you into the game when you're 8 years old, and now you're 16 and you're going to be able to go and play at this elite level club. What's the process for going from an 8-year-old who's new to the game to a 16-year-old who believes that they're going to be able to make a living with the game, besides playing with your brothers and the kids in the neighborhood? What was that process like to go from that 8-year-old to that 16-year-old?
It was just fun. I mean, really, the process was very simple because I was having fun and I didn't stop working. And for me, it was like an addiction. The more I was playing, the more I liked it. And it was so simple. I mean, I didn't have to think about it. Years later, of course, I analyzed and I went through all those memories. And then I realized that, you know, at some point, everyone faces the same challenge, you know, the challenge of being in a journey of self-improvement. And you have to fall in love with boredom. You get bored. Sometimes when you play basketball and you work out, you get bored. I mean, it's just reps and going through the same stuff over and over again. And sometimes it's just boring. I mean, even if you are the guy that loves basketball the most. So when I was 8 and I started to play basketball until when I was playing in Badalona, there were just 8 years where I was playing first for a very small school, and then they recruited me for this famous school that I told you that we were playing championships locally and nationally. And it was just practicing with my teammates and waking up very early to have some strength and conditioning practice before school. And then I remember having practice after the school. And when we finish the practice, we stay there for a little longer. And sometimes we play even when we were already 14, 15 or 13, we still play in mini basketball in very small baskets just to play with contact and have fun and dunk and all that. And it was just having fun all the time. I didn't realize about the process and the meaning of being there every single day with my teammates. It was just, you know, I guess that I fell in love with the boredom of being practicing and being in the court every day.
So did you spend a lot of time during that period of your life working on your game by yourself, in addition to the time that you were putting in with your school team or with your friends in the neighborhood? Were you spending a lot of time on the court working on your game by yourself?
No, not at all. Not at all. We didn't do that back in those days. I don't remember doing that, and I don't remember any of my teammates doing that. We were playing all the time, pickup games, 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 5-on-5. No matter what was the size of the basket, no matter what was the size of the ball, we were just playing. I don't remember people, at least in my school or in my city, I don't remember people working on their game on air. I mean, 1-on-0, you and the ball in the basket. I don't remember that. You could go there and take some shots, but everything was playing with people. Later on, when I was 15 and I was recruited by this important club, I remember spending that summer really intensely working with my brothers, improving my game, because by the age of 15, I was not even able to cross the court dribbling with my left hand and finish with a layup successfully. So I was day and night and literally night, because I remember finishing 11 p.m. working on my dribbling and on my layups to at least being able to, you know, get to Badalona and be a little skill compared to those guys. Those guys were very good. But I have some other things in my work and my ethics and my passion for the game. But that summer is the only summer that I remember going to the court and working with my brothers really hard on improving my skills.
It's interesting because I think here in the United States, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I grew up in a time where I played a lot more basketball outdoors in a playground or in the park than kids do today, at least again here in the States, where kids are playing a lot of games, they're on a team, and they're playing in a gym with kids their own age. And I think that for me, one of the things that I felt led to my development was just what you described, which is I was out of my neighborhood, I was playing against kids who were older, I was playing against adults when I was 13 or 14 years old who would push me around and make me do things that maybe I didn't want to do out on the floor. And I think that's what really helped me to become a better basketball player. And I hear you saying some of those same things, that what you loved about the game was playing the game. And you didn't spend a lot of time by yourself, at least initially, just working on your game. Instead, you were playing the game. And what ends up happening when you're playing the game is you develop that love for it, you develop that passion for it. And in the course of doing that, you don't even realize that you're improving your skills. And I think that's what happened to you. And then that leads to your experience to be able to go and play with Badalona. And so when you get that opportunity, describe what that process is like when they come and they say, hey, we'd like you to come and be a part of our club. Describe what that process is like, and then what your experience was in the first year that you went there.
Yeah, so we were playing a championship in Madrid. In Spain, we have two kind of competitions. We have what it's called school competitions and clubs competitions. But schools can play in clubs competitions, clubs cannot play in school competitions. So we were playing the clubs competitions, even though we were a school, and we were playing pretty good. We got to the semifinals. We got to the final, sorry. And no one told me anything at the moment, but 1 week later when we got back home and I was just having fun with my friends, suddenly a guy showed up in the door and he said, I'm a recruiter from Juventud Badalona and I want to talk with your parents about you coming with us. And I was incredibly psyched. Badalona is without a doubt one of the best youth development programs for years, for decades. There are countless of professional Spanish players that came out from Badalona, and coming to knock at my door, it was just a dream. Just the guys being there interested in recruiting me was just a dream. And they talked to my parents. At the beginning, it was Spain is a small country, so for me, traveling 800 kilometers to go to Barcelona, it was like now flying from Spain to China. And I remember my parents at the beginning, they were very excited, and then my mom got a little scared, and then my dad, and we're talking, I was 16, I was not 11 or 12 years old, I was 16, but it was 1990, it was a long time ago. And so eventually I end up going there, and when I got to Badalona, everything changed. All the things that I said before about not working on my game, everything changed. I moved on from practicing three times a week and playing a game on the weekends to practice every single day, only having Sundays off and sometimes not even that, and working not less than 4 to 6 hours a day. Skill development, strength and conditioning sessions, practice with one team, practice with the older team, having sessions in between classes at school, if you have a recess or if you have lunchtime. Lunchtime in Spain used to be a little longer, sometimes 2 hours, 2 hours and a half. So I remember running to my house, eating something real quick to go and have a skill development session before going back to school, and then finish school and run with my back to have the strength and conditioning session, and then working with my team, and then stay with the older guys. And that was really, really hard. Those 3 years in Badalona, they were really hard. We worked a lot. But of course, my game raised a lot. The level of my game raised a lot, and I became a completely different player, starting to add a lot of things to my game. I didn't know, when I got there, I didn't know how to play without a ball. In my school, all that I was doing was offensive rebound and fast break, transition game. That was it. I didn't shoot at all. I didn't play without the ball. I didn't know what was the back door. I didn't know what was the stagger or pin down screens, or I have no idea about any of that. It was just running and jumping. By the time that I came back from Badalona, it was completely different. I was ready to play professionally. So it was very, very intense those 3 years, but very rewarding. I mean, the process was absolutely brutal. I got injured so many times. My shape, my conditioning was not adequate to that amount, that load of work, and I paid the price for a while. And then I started getting adjusted, and step by step I got better on that too. But it was really, really hard. It was very difficult. And I remember, and this is something that I do remember having conversations, because we were 8 or 9 guys from recruited from outside of Badalona, and we were living all together in the same house. And I remember having conversations about, we didn't realize when we got there, what was that? I remember watching TV and saying, did you know this is going to be like this? And people say, no, man, if I know this is going to be so hard, I don't know if I will come. And then talking about, you know, before you know, you're in the middle of you're in the middle of everything. You're in the middle of it. And until the moment you forget what's happening and you just focus on the next thing. And that was the daily basis. You work, you forget what's going on today, and you just focus on the next thing, which is tomorrow. And that's it. And suddenly you're building a big house brick by brick, and you realize that you're becoming a basketball player.
How many kids were there with you at the time that were a part of the programs there?
Oh, but I don't know, hundreds of kids, maybe 200, 300. We were, let's say, the special kids, because we were recruited from outside, so we got paid. We were already considered professionals by the age of 16, because we were already getting paid. We have our accommodation and school fees covered. I don't know. We went to restaurants where the club has an agreement, so we can go there and have lunch and dinner. We got a lady to come to the house and clean. So we were considered professionals. But beside that, we have all our teammates. They were from Badalona, Barcelona, and the surroundings. And totally, I would say, I don't know, 300, maybe 300, 400 kids.
So what do you remember specifically about some of those skill development sessions? We always hear here in the United States how European countries do things differently in terms of how they develop their players, and obviously the systems are different. But what do you remember specifically about some of the on-court basketball activities that you guys would do at that time that were, A, difficult and challenging, as you described, and also how they helped you to improve your game? Do you remember anything about some of the specific things that you did out on the floor that started to help you become a better player?
Yeah, I mean, in my case, like I said, my skills level were very, I mean, was very low. So for me, everything was pretty much new, but I remember those skill sessions very, very well, very vividly, because I spent so many hours. The coach we had, Mikel Nolis, still today, he's considered one of the best skill development coaches in the country for the last maybe 30 years, 40 years. And working with them every single day was just amazing. No fancy stuff, no crazy sets, no Instagram moves, everything very simple. Moving from playing against no one without defense to go to one-on-one and two-on-two things, and reps and understanding the game. Everything was based on questions. Everything was based on repetitions and routines. Just to, you know, it was meant to be your bread and butter during the game. It was meant to be your tools to be able to be in a position to make a decision during the game. So it was mastering everything that we, for example, dribbling. I remember spending 30 minutes dribbling and doing some all kind of stuff that you can imagine. But no, like I said, I don't remember working fancy stuff, going through 20 cones and doing in between the legs, behind the back, double crossover, triple crossover, pump fakes. I don't remember doing all those things. Everything was applied to the game, to the way we were playing back in those days. With this coach, we were playing free. We have no setups, we have no screens, we have nothing like that. Everything was pass and cut and motion offense where everybody was involved in the game. So it was everything about shooting, a lot because he was a very good shooting coach. A lot of rebounding drills too, not defensive drills. I don't know. It was basic. It was very basic, very intentional. Everything in the right context, no fancy stuff. That's what I remember the most about that.
Head Start Basketball's fall skill development clinics will be held at the Strongsville Rec Center on 4 consecutive Saturdays in October. These skill clinics will be from 4 to 6 p.m. beginning on October 5th. The skills clinics are for boys and girls in grades 1 through 8. If you're looking for a great way to get prepared for your season, sign up for the Head Start Basketball Fall Skill Development Clinics at www.headstartbasketball.com.
What do you remember about what you learned off the floor about being a professional basketball player at ages 16 or 17? What things were you learning that were going to help you prepare for your eventual long pro career off the court? Were there things that you can point to that you recall learning at that time that was going to help you off the floor to adjust to becoming a professional athlete?
Yeah, that was probably one of the biggest lessons from that coach. He was incredible on mentoring kids. I'm still today in touch with him, even though I'm China and he's in Barcelona, and he's just so wise. He's a wise guy with so much knowledge about the game. He cared so much about us, and he was always preparing us for what. I remember when I left Badalona and I was coming back to Leon to start playing professionally, and he wrote me a letter, a handwritten letter, and he explained to me what to do when I have free time during my week. So he said something like, you have to do this and this and this, and then if you go to play, you take seriously the game, because the gym costs money, the lights cost money, people are cleaning the floor for you, the balls cost money, the coaches have to drive and leave their families to be there with you, and you have to respect that. So every time you're in a basketball court, you have to respect all those things and all that people. If you don't want to do that, or if you are not willing to do that, stay outside, go to a playground by yourself and stay there and fool around as much as you want. But every time you go to the gym and you work with someone and someone is doing the effort and making the right choice to be there with you, you have to respect that. That's one of the things that I remember the most. Another one was, the translation would be something like, ego is insecurity with makeup, is not confidence. So you have to be extremely confident every day, but you got to forget your ego in the locker room or in your house, even better. So those 3 years and the 4 years that I spent before in my school with my coach, Pepe Estrada, those two guys, they no doubt, they created my personality and my behavior as a professional basketball player later on. And even today as a coach, when I coach kids now here in China, but before in other countries, of respect the game, respect the people. This is the most important thing of the non-important things, like someone said. But when you are there, this is very serious, and we take it seriously. You know, we don't believe that we are the best because of our egos. We believe that we are the best, or we could be the best, or we compete with the best because of the work that we put in, and because of our confidence on our capabilities, on our abilities.
For sure. I think if you put the time in, it's much easier to have that real sense of confidence as opposed to the false confidence that you mentioned there briefly, where we can kind of pump ourselves up and think that we can project this confidence that's not really there. But you and the other players that went through what you went through to be able to prepare for your professional careers had a sense of true confidence because you knew that there was work behind that confidence. And I think that's key for any basketball player out there, is if you put the time in and you know that you've worked on your skills and you know you've played the game and you've developed your basketball IQ, I think it's much easier to go into a situation being confident. When you left your family at age 16, and describe a little bit about what that was like. Was it difficult to leave your family? Did you think about it in that terms, or was it just such a tremendous opportunity and to do something that you loved that you just looked at it as this is the way my life is going. What was it like for your parents and your brothers and you to be separated in this situation where you were traveling and going there to basically focus on your professional basketball career at that point?
It was a little bit of a mix of everything. Very exciting, similar to the experience when you go to a summer camp and you are so excited about going there and being with other kids and do what you like the most. On the other side, I was a little scared, you know, leaving your house and going to another place. You don't know anyone. You will be there living by yourself for the first time. Of course, we had some people that took care of us, but however, I was not certain of what I was going to find there. And literally, the process to adjust to that experience was the 11-hour train that I had to go from León to Barcelona. And I remember traveling at night, and I didn't sleep not even 1 minute. And I was thinking about, you know, I tried to picture everything in my mind. I was thinking about the opportunity of being, you know, one of the chosen ones to be there, the challenge of being part of a team or of a club with a huge culture of youth development, and maybe the opportunity, embracing also the chance of having the opportunity to play professional basketball for the first time in my life. Also recognizing the effort from my parents to let me go, appreciating the support from my brothers during all those years, and even today, of course, they are my biggest support with my family, and it was really, really an internal process of 11 hours thinking about what I was going to find there, and it was a very tough first couple of months, but I had the support from my family. I mean, my brothers, back in those days, they were still today. They live in Madrid, so they were traveling every month. One of them, they were taking turns, and one of them was driving all the way the weekends to Barcelona, spend with me a few hours, and then come back to Madrid. My parents, they traveled to Barcelona, stay with me for a few days, four times a year. So the first year was an adjustment, and the second year everything was a little more comfortable for everyone. My brothers, they were traveling pretty much every month to go and check on me and stay with me and watch the games because they really love basketball. But the process was pretty complex. And I understand that's one of the other things that I learned there, that the process is what shapes individuals. And I have the responsibility to add value and be additive to the team because me as a player and the rest of my team, as we were shaping the team. And they were telling all the time, you know, process shapes individuals, individuals shape teams. You have to always to be additive. And I try to focus on that. And every time I try to be very intentional with my work and take it very, very seriously because I was aware of the efforts of my family to be away from me and betting on me, giving me the opportunity to pursue my dream and allow me to fight for my goals, you know, and being intentional was the way that I could reward that effort and that bet.
I love what you said about being additive to the team. I think that's a lesson that can apply not just to basketball, but can apply to any situation in life. So if I'm a kid and I'm in school, I should be additive to the class. If I'm an employee at a company, I should be additive to that company. And I think that if we could teach kids through the game of basketball that they should be additive in every situation that they're in, we'd really have something there, Oscar, if we could teach kids that just to make sure that in every situation they were, that they were adding to the, you know, adding to the value of that situation as opposed to taking away from it. And too often, I think we forget that as adults and kids, sometimes we don't look at ourselves in that way. And I think if we did, the world and basketball and everybody would be a lot better off if they could do that. Absolutely. So go ahead.
Absolutely. And we have to be very, very aware of, I'm moving a little bit now to the coaching side. And when we explain the kids when I was working in Spain as a consultant and public speaker, used to work with big companies and entrepreneurs, talking about these all these points and items. And We have to be very careful when we talk to people about being additive, because it seems that many times the addition comes only through the stats. And if you give the people the opportunity of being aware and think about, I can be additive, even if the stats don't reflect them, you give them the responsibility and to make that you are making them accountable of their work every single day. And they know that they can be a very important part of the process, a very important part of the team, no matter if they are doing something that is reflected on the stats or not. And that's our job as coaches. And it's our job to help them to be in a position to make a choice. You don't tell them they can make a choice because they don't add any value that is reflected on the stats. You are not training them to expect the unexpected. How can you work with the kids if you don't let them know that they are valuable? If they understand that they are valuable, it's a lot easier that they can add some value. So we have so many preconceptions about what it's like to talk to the people and tell them, no, you are one of the members of this team. Talking about being a member of this team is like talking about having a membership card of a fitness club. You are there because you pay some money, but I'm not really expecting nothing more from you that behave and don't break up things or, be polite with the rest of the people.
Right.
I'd rather think in other terms. And in Badalona, they were very, they were very intentional on those kind of thoughts and matters.
Yeah, I think it's really important as a coach to make sure that you are providing opportunities for every member of your team to see that they have a role and that their role is valued. And it's easy, obviously, to, as you said, recognize the value added from somebody who's the leading scorer or the leading rebounder or the player that gets the most assists or whatever the case may be, something that can be counted and measured. It's a lot harder to find, and as a coach, to show that the player who might be the 12th man on the team, who doesn't get in the game hardly at all, we have to find, as coaches, we have to find ways to value what that player brings to the table and let them know that they do have value so that, as you said, every kid, every player can have that type of positive experience where they're understanding that, yes, we may not be able to see your name in the box score as having a whole bunch of statistics, but if you hadn't been there at practice all week pushing our starters to get better and improve, or if you hadn't been on the bench bringing so much enthusiasm, or if you hadn't gone through and worked and brought that kind of enthusiasm that's necessary day in and day out, then our team couldn't be as successful. And sometimes another word that I love that you mentioned, and we've talked about it on the podcast a bunch of times, is being intentional. And I think as a coach, if you're going to find value in each and every player, you have to be intentional about that. Otherwise, it's very, very easy to overlook those contributions that aren't right in front of you on the stat sheet. And so I'd love to hear you say that word, intentional. And as a coach, if we could just get ourselves to really think through what it was that we wanted to accomplish day in, day out with each of our players, I think the game would be in a great spot.
Absolutely. And if you are not intentional, you're missing the late bloomers. And I have to consider myself a late bloomer all my life. So I have to defend that figure of the late bloomers and having people around you that trust in you, not only because you are very skilled and you have incredible scoring abilities, but because they trust on your working ethics and they trust on your passion for the game. And of course, at a central level, you need to have certain abilities and frame. But having people around you that say, you know what, don't worry about it. You know, we trust on what you're doing. Basketball is very easy to learn, difficult to master. Keep going through the process, and the choices, And I remember one of the other coaches that I had in Badalona, now he's a very famous coach. He's coaching in Russia, but he's probably one of the best professional coaches in all Europe, Joan Plaza. And he used to say, today's choices become tomorrow's reality. I wrote it down here to not forget it. Today's choices become tomorrow's reality. Excellence or not is based on the next 5 minutes. And I loved it. And I always remembered it. So that's what I try to explain to kids all the time. Say, forget about your stats. Forget about what you've done. Forget about if you miss the side of knot, focus on the next 5 minutes, because that is going to be critical in your development as a player.
That's very important. I think living in the present is something that I hear talked about all the time, that whether it's on the basketball floor where you're focused on the play that's in front of you, you're not worried about what just happened good or what mistake you just made 2 minutes ago, and you certainly can't control what's going to happen a day from now or 5 minutes from now, but you can control that present moment. You can control the way you react to what happens in the present moment, and you can make sure that you're bringing your full attention and effort to that moment. And I think that's important as a coach to relay that information to your players. But I also think that's just an important message for kids to hear outside of basketball, or to use outside of basketball, whether that's in the classroom, whether that's at home with their family. Maybe that's when they're taking music lessons or they're in art class learning how to draw. If you just focus on what's in front of you right now at the very given moment, and you don't worry about what happened before, and you don't worry about what's happening way off into the future, you just focus on the present, I think we tend to get better results when our mind isn't wandering, but rather it's focused on the task at hand that's right in front of us. And again, that could be basketball or that could be something else. And that's what I hear you describing, Oscar.
Absolutely. It is exactly like this.
So when you get done with your 3 years and you start to head towards your long professional career, what is it like for you when you sign your first professional contract to be able to play professional basketball, and you know now that that's going to become your career? Describe what that feeling was like, and maybe what your first year as a true professional basketball player was like for us.
That was crazy, because I got back to my hometown, Badalona. They told me that they were very happy with me. They thought that I could play maybe professional basketball. They didn't know what level, but they were not willing to keep betting on me. So I have to make a decision, stay there and you know, cover all the expenses by myself and keep working with them, go back to my hometown where there was the professional team, where I could have the opportunity maybe to play with them. So I decided to come back home. I had a meeting with the general manager, and then we were talking about, you know, my 3 years there. He was well aware of my work in Badalona. He was following me, as he told me, and he gave me the opportunity of being part of the professional team during the preseason, and we didn't sign any agreement. I mean, we decided, okay, you are going to be with the professional team during the preseason, the training camp, and when the training camp is over, we talk again. And I accepted the challenge, and I was with the professional team during the training camp, and after maybe 1 or 2 weeks, we have a meeting again, and we sign a contract for the next 3 years. I started to work with the pro team every day, and then when I had some time, I also was working with the, what we call the affiliated team. It was a second division team, and with very young kids, and we were having fun. And with the professional team was crazy, because we were already playing playing also not only the ACB, the Spanish competition, we were playing also the College Cup, one of the European club competitions. So we were traveling a lot and working a lot. And I remember that was another stage of my career as a pro player, as a basketball player, because being professional is completely different to all the things that you were involved before. It's, you have to start knowing things from knowing how to relate with the media, how to relate with the sponsors and the patron, or talking to the president of the club, or talking to the authorities of the city, of course with the fans. I was the only, not the only one, I was one of the two guys that we were born in Leon, and after one or two years I was the captain of the team already. So having to be in many meetings and you know, in celebrations and stuff, you have to get to know the people and know who you can talk to about what, and then of course on and off the court I was learning a lot. I was very, very fortunate to have people surrounding me that they helped me a lot on my process to become a professional player. There was a guy used to play for the national team, Spanish national team in Barcelona, Xavi Fernandez. He was a true mentor for me the first year. He took me under his wing. helped me out through all the process. And I remember the first season I played 36 minutes in the whole season in our local competition, the ACB Spanish competition. But in Europe, I play a little more and I play pretty good. So the next year I have a more important role. And then the second year, I have the biggest influence coming from Harold Presley. Harold Presley played for Villanova and played with Sacramento Kings in the NBA. And it was very important to me, that giving me confidence to play more minutes and start building a career for myself. And, you know, Oscar, you have to trust on your game. You can play. You can be in this competition. You can be in a position to compete with everyone. You have to be honest with your work. Never relax. Take your job very seriously and don't waste any opportunity to get better. Talk to people, ask questions. And that was very important to me. But the process was very, very exciting. I enjoy every single day of my those first pro years. I enjoy every single day. Everything was new for me. And everything was an opportunity to become what it was a dream for me and for so many other kids in my city and in my country. So I was really fortunate, and I always try to have my feet on the ground and not thinking that I was kind of special. It was just a matter of recognizing the reward of my countless hours of working in a basketball court.
Can you point to one or two things in those early years that you just loved about being a professional basketball player at that point? What were, just pick out something, one or two things that you really loved about being a pro player at that time.
Traveling. I remember enjoying traveling a lot and playing in different gyms, playing against different people. I remember enjoying that a lot. Countless hours of bus drives, speaking with the American players. That's where I learned to speak English, even if I do it poorly.
You do it pretty well.
But that was the moment. My best teacher was my first year with Joe Wolf. Joe Wolf is the head coach now, Greensboro Swarm, the G League team for the Charlotte Hornets.
From North Carolina.
North Carolina, yeah. Yeah. And he's one of my best friends in the United States, no doubt. And we keep in touch pretty much weekly, every 2 weeks. And we were talking about so many things. And he taught me how to speak English, and I told him a little bit of Spanish, and we were talking about music and so many things. And on the court, I remember starting to make the difference in between shooting volume sessions, where the goal and the objective was to shoot a lot of shots, just thinking and trying to put your mind on mechanics and getting your confidence back if you lost it, or building your, what I call, and you, if you want, we can go through that later, what I call the shooter's battery. And knowing that there are other sessions and other moments during the workouts where it's not about volume, it's about shooting like in the game, very quick, focusing on the outcome and shooting to get a goal of, I don't know, maybe score 8 out of 10, or I don't know, whatever is the goal. I never did that in my life. All my shooting sessions were exactly the same, and I started to get the word back, to be more intentional in my work. So everything that we were doing, it was because of a reason. If you have to be here in this particular spot of the court, it's because of a reason. You're part of a watch. If you are not there in the right moment, in the right spot, ready to shoot, you are messing with the machine of the watch, and you are not respecting the guy that set a screen for you. You are not respecting the guy that is dribbling and bringing the ball to you. You are not respecting the guy on the weak side, that is on the strong side, that is trying to give you and provide you with the opportunity and an advantage to shoot. So I remember being more and more and more intentional about that, and starting to identify the context and all the things that I could manipulate when I was playing, because I was not the best athlete in the court by far. I'm a 6'7" player, but I was not really fast, or I jumped very high. I was pretty strong, but I tried to build my brain muscle as much as possible and build my basketball IQ as much as possible by paying attention. So even today, I'm a very detailed coach because details are the key when you play at a certain level.
Yeah, I think sometimes as a player, if you are forced to develop your basketball IQ and maybe get away with being a more fundamental player as opposed to relying on your athleticism, I think that sometimes translates into being able to relay and teach the game well, because you had to make sure that you had mastered the fundamentals in order to get to the level of basketball that you were able to get to. As you were playing, when did you start to get involved with the national team and think that you might have an opportunity there to represent Spain in international competition? When did that come about?
You know, as I said before, as a late bloomer, I was never part of a youth national team. Not U16, U14, U18, like so many other kids that they were playing professional at the same time that I was. So my first experience with the national team was a friendly tournament during the season, because one of the guys from the national team was injured. I was the season, I remember maybe I was 21, 22, and the season before I was named the rookie of the year of the competition of the ACB. So the next season, when we have some break, the national team have a couple of friendly games in Madrid and also in my hometown, and the Spanish national team coach, he knew me from my time in Badalona, so he called me for those games, and I had the chance and the opportunity of being with the national team for maybe 4 days, and it was incredible. I mean, it was an amazing experience. Also, the first game was in Madrid. I played okay, just okay, but the second game we played in my hometown against in front of my crowd, in front of my people. And it was a crazy night. I scored something like 26 points in 20 minutes or something like that. And it was just a blast. You know, for me, it was one of the most incredible experiences. After that, that summer, I was about to be called by the national team, the U23, to go to play a European tournament. And I broke my foot 2 weeks before the training camp was starting. So I missed that one. And then the next one, I had the opportunity to play the Mediterranean Games. It's like the Olympic Games, but for the Mediterranean countries. With the Spanish national team, we got the gold medal. And that was the first time that I really enjoyed a full experience with the national team. And that was it. After that, I didn't have any other chance with the national team until I was 30. That's another reason why I call myself a late bloomer, going to the national team to be at in the Olympics. Because the year before, when I was 29, in 2003, I was with the national team, but I was one of the guys that was took out of the list in the last moment. They discard me about a week before the competition was starting. It was the European Champions, if I remember well, 2003. And 2004, I went to the Olympics, and that was the most unbelievable experience that I could ever have, being an athlete, just being there surrounded by the best athletes in the world in the Olympic Village. Also, I don't know, maybe I'm just a little freak, but it was in Athens, you know, where the Olympics and the sports are so important. And, you know, the environment was incredible, having the chance of talking even with other people from other disciplines. Yeah, that's no doubt that's the highlight of my professional career. Being in the stadium in the opening ceremony was something that I will never forget.
All right, two questions from that. One is, describe the process for how Spain goes about selecting which players are going to be on the roster for the Olympics. So let's answer that first, and then I have a question for you related to your experience at the Olympics. So just answer, how did the team roster come together for the Olympics that year?
Well, that's too bad you asked me the question today, because yesterday I was talking with Sergio Scariolo, the national team coach, so I could ask him how they do that. But, I guess it's pretty much always the same. You know, you have as a coach, you have a certain idea of the players that you want to have, and you mix and have a balance in between I don't like to talk about the best players in the country because I don't believe that the best are going. I believe the best for that kind of tournament, for that kind of coach, and in the best shape. Of course, there are some names, they always have to be there. In that moment, I don't know, Pau Gasol or Navarro, they have to be there no matter what. But there are some other players that they complement what they already have, and it depends on the last couple of seasons. So they think about you in terms of what kind of value can you bring to the table. And sometimes, you know, you need the 10th, 11th, or 12th player to be someone that keeps a very positive attitude for the team, a little bit ready for everything, you know, whatever is the job that you wanna order or ask from them. It's a complicated process because in Spain, for example, every summer it's the same thing with football. Everyone knows and have their own list. So I'm sure that this year, for example, Escariolo, back in those days, the coach have like 20, 25, 30 names for sure to choose. And then if you are lucky enough to be in the last 16 and go to the training camp, when you go there, there is just there, you know, 8 or 9 names, sometimes 10 are already fixed for the final list. And then the other 2 guys, they have to fight. They have to, I mean, it's really, really complicated to work there every single day, knowing that you have 6 guys competing for 2 spots. Sometimes in the same position, sometimes not in the same position. There are a lot of tactical knowledge that you have to acquire and learn in very short time, and it's not easy. The pressure is high. The experience is overwhelming. It's not easy at all. But the opportunity, I mean, it's worth. You know, you have to make it worth.
So were you one of those guys that had to fight it out for the last spots on that team, or were you a guy that had already secured your position based on your performance in the last few years?
No. I didn't have anything secure. No. I had to fight. The first time that I went there, 2003, like I said, they rolled me out the last week before going to the competition. In the Olympics, I was not, let's say that I was not fixed until 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks before the competition. After me, there was another guy, one point guard, that he was, you know, he was out of the list in the last moment. Actually, the last day, the guy was out, and that was pretty painful for him and for everyone else. But I secured my position maybe 2 weeks before, or 1 week before going to the Olympics. I remember being at the hotel, and one of the trainers comes to me and he says, I'm not supposed to tell you, but I have a surprise for you. Just go to the room. And so I go to the room and I see we had these huge bags, huge luggage for the Olympics, you know, all customized and all that. And that was mine with my name and all that. And I was about to cry there. It was just an amazing moment. But yeah, like I said, I was a late bloomer all my career, so even to secure my position, I was a late bloomer at the end.
Who was the first person you called when you found out you made the team?
Oh, my wife. Yeah, I called my wife. I said I made it. Then I called my mom and dad and my brothers. And yeah, first person was my wife, then my family.
And your brothers are probably saying, I'm glad we made you play basketball back then, right?
Oh, you cannot, Jason, you cannot imagine how many times they told me that.
And he probably still did, right?
Yeah, even today they say, oh, all of those things that you did, we shouldn't keep you away from football, and let's see how that goes.
That's funny. It's amazing how life can turn. It's amazing how life can turn on a simple decision like that. And you know, again, who knows? If it hadn't been for your brothers, maybe you would have kept on playing soccer, and who knows where you would have ended up. It's just incredible how life can take those turns. Let's talk a little bit about your Olympic experience. Before we talk about the basketball piece of your Olympic experience, I want to ask you, what athlete other than a basketball player that maybe you got to talk to or that you got to watch while you were there, did you come away the most impressed with, or what athlete did you notice, or what moment did you appreciate that another athlete was able to have in the Olympic Games while you were there?
Well, I had so many special moments because, you know, I didn't play that much in the Olympics. I played very few minutes. So I was not tired, you know. I had so much time to walk around the villa. So we were walking around and you can go to the track and field. I remember like today, the feeling of being sitting on the track and field and seeing the Jamaican 400 relay practicing, working out. And the feeling on the ground was like horses running. So much power and intensity and speed. I mean, it was unbelievable to see them there. Just, I mean, I was sitting, the guys were running just like 2 feet away from me. And also I remember having a conversation with a Mexican swimmer, because you think about swimmers and you don't think about a Mexican guy. And the guy was so excited about being there, and we related to each other very well. And we were talking about the experience and all the struggles and the things that he has to go through to be there. And then, of course, one of the best African runners ever. I don't recall his name right now, but the guy had already like 6 Olympic medals by the time. And so humble, so normal. And talking about, you know, for me, this is a very special moment. Every year, every time that I have the opportunity to be at the Olympics, I enjoy it as a kid. And I admire you guys, basketball players, so much. And sometimes I wish I was a team player, because, you know, I'm running by myself all the time. And it was just incredible to have that opportunity to talk to people, because, you know, sometimes we don't understand this. We basketball players, we work for the next weekend. Like I said before, we work for the next weekend. We go through the process focusing on what's next, and what's next most of the times is just the next weekend. Only when you are playing a tournament like this and you start the training camp for 6 weeks and you focusing on what's going on at the end when you go to the tournament. But those athletes, some of them, they were working for 4 years. So they were preparing a 4 years competition. During 4 years, they are preparing for 1 week, which is amazing. I mean, the mental training required for that, it's just absolutely, I mean, it blew my mind. I was talking with them and I realized how fortunate we were to not being forced to be working by ourselves every single day, thinking, oh, you know, it's only 36 months to the competition from now. It's just, I mean, I wouldn't be able to do that. That's for sure. Being around the villa, you realize that not every sport is the same. Not every athlete is the same. But when you are there, it's like a brotherhood. And I was very, very fortunate and honored to be part of that.
Yeah, that I think has to be just an incredible experience to be able to represent your country in an international competition and then have the chance to be able to rub shoulders and talk with some of the greatest athletes on the planet, probably in sports that in a lot of cases you had not spent a lot of time watching, thinking about, being interested in. But then when you meet the human being behind the athlete who maybe is doing a sport that you're not as familiar with or something that, again, is interesting to you. I think that what you just described, those conversations that you were able to have and the things that you were able to watch there to be part of the Olympics had to be just a tremendously special experience. And as you described, it was the highlight of your professional career. What do you remember about the basketball side of that experience and some of the guys that you were able to play with who – people who might be here listening to in the United States, you had some teammates who ended up playing here in the NBA.
Still are playing in the NBA. Yeah, just signed a contract, right?
You know, so we had Jose Calderon here in Cleveland for a year or two, I believe.
Cup of coffee.
And obviously, Powell's had a great career. And we were just talking before we got on because we were looking at the roster, and Rudy Fernandez is a guy that, you know, when he first came over here to the United States, I think a lot of people thought that he was going to really have a tremendous NBA career, and it ended up not happening for him, and he ended up going back and obviously being a very successful player in Spain. So just talk a little bit about your experience with the guys that were your teammates for that Olympic Games and how special it was to be a part of that group.
It was really special. I don't want to forget anyone, but that team, we also had Iker Iturbe, used to be a Clemson guy, pretty good there. Navarro play one of the best European players of the last 2 decades, no doubt. He played for the Washington Wizards and Memphis, I believe, if I recall well. We had Jorge Garbajosa, right now he's the president of the Spanish Federation. He played for the Raptors. It was incredible. You know, the talent of that team was amazing. And on the bright side, I would say, speaking about basketball per se, I would say, you know, the feeling of that year we could do something really, really great because we beat everyone by 20, 19, 20, 20 something, Serbia, Argentina, China. I mean, everything was very, very well until we crossed paths with United States. And United States was not playing very well. And they played really well against us. We didn't play not at all like we played the days before. And it's the first time. And still today, I remember the other day we were talking with a journalist here. And if I don't know the stats. I don't dig on that too much. But he told me it's the first time that a team wins 7 games, lose one, and finish seventh. You know, it's crazy that you can have an 8-7 record and you finish seventh in a championship, like the Olympics.
Correct me if I'm wrong. LeBron had a really good game against you guys, right?
I remember Dwayne Wade.
Okay.
Yeah, Dwayne Wade playing a lot better. I mean, Dwayne Wade was like all over, stealing balls on the first passing line and dunks, shooting threes, driving. I remember, I'm not saying the other guys didn't have an impact on the game, but the name that comes to my mind when I remember that game was Dwayne Wade, no doubt. I remember that we went into a 2-3 zone offense, not a 2-3, it was a matchup zone offense that used to give us very good results, but they were just on fire. I mean, they scored such that they didn't score before that game and they didn't score after that game. So, like I say, Argentina, I'm not saying that we were better than Argentina, but during the preparation of the Olympics and in the Olympics, we beat Argentina by 20 points.
Yeah, and, so you can say you beat the team that won the gold medal. So you can say that. That's what you can say.
I mean, the stats are there. We play in Madrid, a tournament, at least one game in Madrid. I don't know if we play two, maybe another one in South Spain. We play one or two games against them before the Olympics. And then we were in the same group in the Olympics. And I don't remember right now the scores, really, but we beat them pretty easily both times or all three times. And Argentina did it very well. I mean, they were very solid. They knew that the group was not the main goal for them. And we were, I would say, unlucky enough to cross paths with the United States in their best moment of the tournament. Because if we keep playing the way we played and USA keeps playing the same way they played during the group, because they were not the first in the group. They came to the second round a second. That's why they crossed with us. And I remember the game. We were very excited. We really thought that we had the chance of beating them. But it's also true that most of the guys, they were very young. You know, Pau Gasol, Navarro, all those guys, they were 24 years old. Rudy was 18 by the moment. Some of us, we were a little older, but many young people. And I would say that experience built what the Spanish team became the years later, where they could won the world championship and got very good performances in different competitions.
Yeah, I'm sure that experience in 2004 was invaluable for those guys that continued to be a part of the national team moving forward. I'm sure that is what eventually led to the tremendous success that they were able to have in future competitions. As you were continuing your professional career, at what point did you start to think that when your career eventually ended, that you might want to get into coaching? Was that something that you always had in the back of your mind, or was it something that you sort of came to the realization that, hey, my career is coming to an end. I love this game. I want to stay involved in it. Maybe I should think about coaching, or was coaching something that you'd always had in the back of your mind?
No, not at all. It's true that when I was playing, I was always thinking, how do we play like this? Why we do what we do? I was always thinking and evaluating the way we were playing and trying to find the purpose of that, because finding the purpose of that gave me more opportunities to understand how could I be dangerous in the court. So that was my goal. Every time that I was in the court, I was trying to be dangerous and having an impact on the game, whether on defense or on offense. And I found the real understanding of the game trying to study everything surrounding my performance and my role and the rest of my teammates' roles. And like a really, really intense relationship, when I broke up with basketball and I stopped playing professionally, I got 2 years that I didn't want to know anything about basketball at all. Like, I didn't watch a game. I didn't read anything related with basketball. I moved forward. I was working in so many other things. I didn't play basketball. It was, I don't know. I'm not saying I was hurt by the fact that I could not play professionally anymore, but I didn't like the way that everything ended. And then years later, I realized that only the very, very successful and fortunate ones decide when to stop, and they are happy with the ending. Most of the people are not happy with the ending because of the injuries, because of the market, because of the team's needs, because of your own personal needs and situations. But very, very few people are happy with the way their careers finished. So that was my case. I had a very hard time those 2 years after I stopped playing basketball. And then one day I remember one of my friends called me and said, can you come over and help me with these kids? You know, we practicing, and maybe you can come over and, you know, teach them a little bit about how to shoot and spend some time with us. And I was there, and that was it. The moment that I was in the court with the kids, everything changed. Everything went back to what's supposed to be normal for me, because that was my life. I realized that I wanted to spend time in the basketball court. Still today, every time I go to the basketball court, it feels like I'm ready to play. And I get really, really excited. Even yesterday we got a friendly game here, and I was preparing myself 2 hours before, like if I was ready to play. I still have that fire inside of me, and that mix of anxiety and uncertainty of I know what I have to do, and I'm really willing to compete today and all that. And I realized that's the thing that I was ready to do the next couple of years. And then the China opportunity came, and then I realized that I needed to study and improve my knowledge and my expertise on basketball, not just allowing myself to teach people based on my experience as a pro player, but studying and being a better coach by understanding that there are so many things that you can compare in between being a player and being a coach, but there are so many other things that they are not comparable. It's not the same. It's a different role with different amount of hours that you have to dedicate. So many small and big aspects of the game that you have to take care of, and then you have to take care of the kids and all the guys. And I really like that part too. And I got my license from the Spanish Basketball Federation, and I started to work as a coach here in China and other countries.
So before you went and your friend asked you to come and work with those kids, at that point, you still it had never really crossed your mind that maybe coaching was something that you should try. It was just like this light bulb moment where all of a sudden you went from, I've kind of given up basketball for a couple of years to, man, all of a sudden I want to coach. That's kind of an amazing story, Oscar.
Yeah, it is what it is. It is just like that. I mean, I didn't have any... I don't remember watching video, going to a video session with the team and thinking, that's what I would love to be doing.
That's interesting.
I remember enjoying my conversations with coaches, especially in my last years as a player, providing, you know, my view of, I don't know, I remember one time we were talking about how to play defense on a pin down situation against a team, and there how we could stop that pin down situation. I was telling the coach, you know, based on my experience, I probably would be doing this and this and this, because if we do this on the strong side, on the weak side, we will be able to rotate in an easier way. And I remember enjoying those conversations. I always loved the idea of, I love the tactical side of the I love the technical side of the basketball, of course. I'm a skill development coach too, but I really like the tactical side of basketball. And then what I do is I try to apply all those tactical skills, I mean, all those tactical details to tactical skill development for the players. And I remember enjoying a lot of those conversations and thinking about the game of basketball, a little bit of like a chess game. And if he goes there, where can I go? If I go there, what is this guy going to do? But not thinking about it as a coach, at least not I didn't realize that I was thinking about it as a coach. Maybe it was just part of the process, and I didn't think about that part of the process as what it was. But it was a light bulb moment. I mean, really, I remember even today when I got back home after being with my friend those kids, and I told my wife, I probably want to be related with basketball again. And she was like, what are you talking about?
That's funny.
I said, yeah, I was with the kids and I enjoyed so much being there, you know, because I remember myself being on the court, those faces and that, you know, the kids being hungry to learn and ready to do whatever you say and looking up at you and say, oh, the coach told me I was shooting great, I was drilling and doing this, and I improved my game just in 1 hour and all that. And I enjoyed so much that I came back home and I decided that, yeah, probably that will be what I will be doing the rest of my life.
Yeah, it sounds like you were having conversations, and even though you hadn't formalized your thought process of saying, hey, I want to be a coach, it sounds like from those conversations that you had with coaches and just kind of the way you've always thought the game as a player, that it was probably in there. But it's interesting that you never made that connection between, hey, I'm having these conversations with coaches, I'm interested in the tactical side of the game. But it's interesting that it never crossed your mind that someday you might end up in coaching. I think that's just an amazing story.
You know, I guess I was just too focused on being a player.
Right, understood.
So I was just focused on understanding the game the best way possible. But even when I was involved in conversations with coaches about what we were doing, and I already have a very important role in my teams, I was not seeing that as a part of a coaching process. I was seeing that as part of my development as a player until the very last day that I was a pro player. So it's okay. We you and me, Mike, we talk about what are we going to do during the game. I give you my perspective as a player. You give me your thoughts and ideas, and you instruct me on what to do as a coach. But once the conversation is over, I just take everything that I need to go to the court and perform as well as possible, you know? And I guess I was curious about that, but I didn't think about it as a part of the coaching process, not by far.
Yeah, and coaching, I think, as a player, especially when you're focused in and you love playing the game the way you did, and you played it for so many years, that I think you begin to think of yourself in just one way. You're kind of on one track, and I think you always thought of yourself as a player, and it never occurred to you to think of yourself anywhere else until you had removed basketball from your life for a couple of years. And then once you got a taste of it to come back, I think it was clear. And I could say that I know that if that had been the case for me, that I would have jumped right back into it, because I think once that love of the game inflicts you, I think it's hard for it to go away for somebody who loves the game as much as it's clear from our conversation that you love the game. So what was your first opportunity then after you come back and you tell your wife, hey, I want to get back into basketball and I think I want to coach? What's your first formal coaching opportunity that you got? And then describe a little bit about what that was like.
It was a few months later that after that bold moment. Not a professional, I mean, it was not a coaching position per se. I was part of the one of the local federations in Spain and helping the program to doing them some very specific shooting program for the kids during the summer, because I still have my job back in those days. So I was, you know, just trying to find some part-time moments to dedicate to basketball. But what I did was I started to watch a lot more basketball, a lot studying and talking with people. And then the next few years before I moved to China, I was working with some pro players, doing some skill development sessions with them. I never was very interested on the people knowing that I was available as a coach. I was just doing things for the people that I knew, trying to help with schools and programs and academies and summer camps, individual sessions. But I consider that I needed to improve my knowledge of how to teach basketball properly instead of trying just to find the first opportunity for myself. So I was, like I said, more focused on studying and watching basketball as much as possible, trying to go to between 150, 200, 200 or 250, depending on the year, games watched every season from different competitions and analyzing and talking with coaches. And then it was just a natural process. After a few years doing this, I got the opportunity to come to China, and it was an opportunity to come to work for a basketball academy. They were opening one of their branches in the northeast of the country, and I had the chance of, let's say, apply everything that I learned in a very, very low level basketball academy. And I took that chance as an opportunity to know basketball and everything related with teaching skill development and basketball to kids, slicing all the details and slicing all the concepts to the smallest part, because the level here was very, very low compared to Spain, very, very low. So everything that I have to explain, I have to, you know, chop it in very, very small pieces to the kids. Most of them, they didn't understand me. They don't understand me. So I had to make it very simple. I have to make it very visual so they can follow me. And I took, especially the three first years that I was in China, I took them like my coaching school to understand that. After that, as a matter of fact, now when I work with some pro players or college guys here in China, I can realize that I improved my coaching skills by coaching the small kids a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure if you can explain it to an 8-year-old who's played very, very little basketball, then your ability to teach and work with that kid, I'm sure, translates to being a better teacher and a coach when you get to a higher level player, for sure. I love what you did and how you described it, in that when you wanted to become a coach, you didn't just naturally assume that because you had been a really good player and had played professionally for such a long time, you didn't just take it for granted that you could walk out and become a coach. I love how you said that what was important to you was to learn how to be a coach and what it took to be a coach and the things that you needed to be successful as a coach. You went out to seek those things by building relationships with other coaches, by attending camps and clinics, by taking the time to invest and learn, so that when you did get the right opportunity to become a coach, you were going to be prepared to be the best that you could be for your players. And I think oftentimes, and I think I fall into this category, is when you've played and you've played at a relatively high level, you kind of automatically assume that I know a lot about the game. At least I did. And I was young when I finished my playing career after college. My first coaching job I got, I think I was 23 years old, and I was a junior varsity basketball coach here. And I remember thinking, well, I'm going to be really good at this. I know a lot about the game. I've been playing ever since I was little, and now I'm going to transition right into coaching. And I remember that first year being way, way more difficult than what I would have thought. And part of me wishes that I would have done what you did, which is to immerse myself in the learning process of what it really takes to be a good coach. And I think that had I done that, let's say I had taken a year to really go out and read and go to camps and go to clinics and build relationships with other more experienced coaches, I think I would have gone into the coaching profession far more prepared. And it sounds really like that's what you were able to do. And I think that's a credit to you, that you were able to recognize that you needed those skills in order to be the type of coach that you wanted to be. Who was the relationship with that got you the opportunity to go to China? How did that come to pass? Who did you know? Who did you talk to? How did you get that opportunity to go over and leave your home country and go to China to work at this academy?
I talked to everyone. I talk to everyone. I spend months and months and months creating relationships and trying to learn from people and exploring opportunities, literally in the five continents. I mean, everywhere, like everywhere. And then eventually one of my contacts and a Slovenian coach that she's working, she still works for the NBA academies and the NBA organization. I don't know where she is right now. I don't know if she's in the States. She used to run the Goran Dragic camps in Slovenia.
Okay.
Back in those days, she was working here, Vanya Zernivek. And back in those days, she was working at the NBA Yao Ming Basketball Academy in Beijing. I asked her if they have any openings. She told me, not at the moment, but she knew about another academy that they have openings, and they were, like I said before, they were opening many branches around China. So I talked to the guy in charge of the hiring process. He was an American guy, very nice guy, still a very good friend of mine, John Culber from Alaska, I believe. And he gave me the opportunity of coming here and start. You know, there were two things about coming here. The most important one, the biggest one, was my son. Me and my wife, we were thinking about what can we do that using basketball as a tool can give us the opportunity of improving my son's education, our son's education. So we realized that the China opportunity would be something invaluable for him. So when we moved here in 2005, he was 10 years old. And now with 14 years old, he's bilingual. He speaks English and Spanish pretty much the same. And he also has a very good level of Chinese. He met some friends from all over the world, at least 10 or 12 nationalities inside of the classroom every year. So that was the biggest experience and that's so far, and no doubt about it, the biggest reward of our time here in China. And the second thing was basketball. You know, it was something that could give me the opportunity of work and develop my ability as a coach. I'm still in the process. I try to talk and organize calls and talks every single week. I'm very fortunate of having a good relationship and friendship with a few NBA coaches, college coaches, European coaches, a lot of them, and we talk, and I ask questions, and I ask from them advice, and I'm still in that process of trying to be a better coach every single day, because the more I know, the more I realize that I have no idea what I'm doing. And it's a scary process, very exciting, but it's scary because every day I realize that, and every day, like yesterday after the game, I was thinking about it. So every day I realize the impact that you have when you do or when you don't, or when you don't do anything, when you say or you don't say anything. The fact that you play basketball makes the people to look at you in a different way, especially in my case. You know, here there are not so many foreign coaches in China, so now pretty much everyone around me in the city knows me, and they come and watch and they look at you in a different way. So the responsibility and the impact that you have, not only on the players that they are on the court with you, but also on the people watching and looking around, it's really big. You know, I remember when I was very small and I started playing basketball, watching some other coaches, and I remember some of them doing things that I hated. I didn't understand why some people could be physical on a player, or how someone could disrespect a player just because he made a mistake. You know, learning is a process, and everyone understands that when you learn, you make mistakes. I mean, if I have to learn how to cook Asian cuisine right now, I will be a mess, and I would hate that I have a Chinese cook beside me yelling at me, screaming at me, or pushing him in the kitchen because I'm not cutting the tofu in the right way. You know?
Right.
And I always tell the people, and say, you know, learning is essentially a force of nature. I mean, it's something that pushes you. And learning is what makes the adaptation possible. If we don't allow the people to learn and make mistakes, how do you want them to adapt to the things that you wanna put on the court? I mean, it's just... It doesn't work. It's impossible. There is no way around.
And there's no question. That's total common sense. I think there's two great lessons that you shared there, Oscar. And the one is the fact that we have to allow kids, basketball players, to be able to make mistakes. Because without mistakes, there is no learning. So that's number one. And then the second thing that you talked about is being a lifelong learner. And I think that that's something that if you would have talked to 23-year-old Mike, I would have told you that I knew most everything that it would have taken to be a good coach. And if you talk to 49-year-old Mike, I would tell you, just like you said, that I know almost next to nothing about what it takes to be a very good coach. And so I think that those of us in all walks of life, and I've probably come to this maybe later than I should have and maybe later than other people. So anyone who's out there, take this advice to heart. But the more you can develop yourself as, again, in your chosen profession. So right now we're talking about coaching, but I look at personal development as how can I get better in every aspect of my life, with my family, with my job, with my business, with everything that I do, how can I continue to get better and improve? And the way you do that is by going out and learning. And you can learn from people, you can learn from books, you can learn now from the internet, you can learn in so many different ways. And I think those are two great lessons to pull out of what you said, that we should always be lifelong learners. And not only that, but we want to make sure that we allow our players to make mistakes. And if we do those two things, I think as coaches, we're going to be at least headed down the road towards success for sure.
It's for former players, it's really important to keep your identity small. And by this, I mean that as a former player, in my case, as a former professional player, Olympic athlete, and all that, those things on my resume, the more I realized about this when I was away from basketball, 2 years away from basketball, and I had so much time to think about it, so many days that I was reflecting on this because I was in pain. I mean, it was really difficult for me to stay away from basketball, but I hated it at the moment. And I realized the more I let a single belief to define me, the fact that I was a player, the less capable I was to adapt when the life was challenging me. It's keeping my identity small, keeping our identity small, it's basic. And in this case, talking about former players becoming coaches is basic because people still believe, because of my identity as a player, I will do very well at coaching. And it's not true. Life is going to challenge you. And someone that never played basketball but has a 15-year high school career and experience, he's going to destroy you in the court. I've seen so many times former players going straight to the coaching position and being there completely lost. Because it's not the same to be in the practice when no one's around to tell you. You have no pressure of the scoreboard to say, oh, we are going to do this and this. And in Spain, we have a saying, an expression that says, the board holds everything. You know, everything you draw on the board looks very good. And every drill, when you prepare them, you know, it looks very good. It seems that it's going to work and you are going to be the next inventor of the new tactical development of the world. And then you go to the court and you realize it's not going to work. You still can see it, you know, and it's a very nice and funny example. In the last game that Argentina played against in the World Cup, not the last one. Yeah, the last one. Because they play today. The last game that Argentina plays, the last timeout of the game, the head coach gives the board to the assistant coach, which is a friend of mine, Silvio Santander, gives the board to design the last play of the game. And when he's drawing that on the board, Luis Escola says, it's not going to work. There is no room for that pass. And the coaches say, don't worry about it. There is room for the pass. And it was. There was room for the pass, and Escola scored a three, and they won the game. You know, it's really important to understand that as a player, you have an identity, you know some things, but as a coach, you know so many other things. And you have to make a difference in between the player that is a player, the player that is becoming a coach, and when you are a coach and you realize that there are so many things that require your effort and your hard work, that just like when you were a player, and you have to study and you have to be aware of the responsibility of being a coach of a team and realize that the process is you need an immense sense of self-curiosity every single day. You cannot be a coach with that sense of self-curiosity. It's just basic for you.
There's no doubt. I think that you have to be curious. You have to want to learn. And if you do, then you have a chance to be successful. If you are a former player and you think that just because you played, that's going to qualify you to be a good coach, that I can vouch for it. That doesn't happen. I know the first year that I coached, second year I coached, I wasn't a very good coach. Again, because I was not necessarily open to all the things that we just described, which is how you go about learning and trying to improve and make yourself better. And the first thing, you have to be self-aware to know what you don't know. And I'm certainly much more self-aware today than I was way back then. We're coming up, Oscar, towards an hour and a half. I want to ask you one final question, and that is just a little bit about what you're doing day to day there in China. So what is your, what's your daily routine look like? What are you doing on a daily basis there for your organization? And then after you share that with us, we'll come back and we'll wrap up the episode.
My, let's say my work daily splits in two parts. One is the sports management role with a Chinese company. We build programs for kids, sports programs for kids at schools, because the biggest problem that China, same thing as Iran, is that in most of the Asian countries, or at least the ones that I know, they don't compete at school. There are no school competitions. There are not school A against the school B on the weekends, and the next weekend school A against the school C. There is not that kind of competition. So for the Chinese kids, it's really difficult to keep working every day, practicing without having the opportunity of compete. If you have competition and collaboration every time, and cooperation every time you talk about sports. If you took out the competition part, kids don't see the point of being there every single day, cooperating and working with the same kids, not having the chance of proving themselves against other teams. So what we do here, and funny enough, we do it with football, not with basketball right now, because that's where all the efforts and the money and the focus are from the Chinese government. We trying to implement school programs and school competitions around China to allow the kids to have the chance of play every weekend, and hopefully that will increase the pool talent of the Chinese sports. And we are very fortunate and honored of being the first company ever that had that opportunity in China to start working on the school programs. And on the other side, every day from Monday to Saturday, I coach a college team here in Guangzhou in south of China, preparing them to the CUBA, the college tournament next year. And I'm very happy with the work that we're doing. We changed so many things since March, and the guys had an incredible and difficult process adjusting to the things that I was demanding from them. But right now we're starting to see the light, and they are very happy to see how they separate themselves from the rest of the Chinese teams, because the way we play has nothing to do with the way they play. So they are very excited about that. That gives me the opportunity of improve my coaching skills. That gives me the fun and the joy and the time to get away from my work a little bit. And after that, the rest of my day, I use it to study and watch games. I have to also be ready for my scouting jobs and consulting jobs with clubs and college programs from many different places and countries. And so you have to be updated. I'm downloading right now all the games from the World Cup. So by the time that the World Cup is finished, I will go through every single one of the games on the tournament to start analyzing, studying the things that, because the level of this tournament, it's been really, really high, crazy high.
You are a busy man, Oscar. That's all I'll
say. I think that 39-year-old that shut down Giannis Antetokounmpo should be high on your priority list.
He is already. Yeah. he is already. We have a little problem with his passport and his age, but definitely Anderson Varejao did a great job there. And Brazil understood very well, because his coach is a really smart coach. Asa Petrovic is a brilliant guy, very intelligent. And they understood very well what they had to do to stop. I mean, actually, I read that Asa Petrovic was not concerned about Antetokounmpo at all. He was just concerned about Lucas and all the guys. But they did a great job stopping the threat of a huge player like Antetokounmpo.
For sure. Oscar, we can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us tonight. It's been a lot of fun. I feel like we could keep going for another hour and a half easily. There's a whole bunch of things that I think we still can touch on. So at some point, we may have to have you come back on and talk to us again. But for right now, I'd like you to share how people can reach out to you and get in touch with you. And then if there's anything else that you want to leave us with before we come back and we'll do our little sign off.
About how to get in touch with me, very easy. My email address is my name and first, I mean, it's Oscar Yebra, OscarYebra @hotmail.com. And be careful with this, .es from Spain, not .com. Many people make a mistake there and you will not be able to reach. and Twitter handle, it's @OyebraF from Oscar Yebra Fernandez or Yebra. You can reach out there as well. I'm not very active on Twitter, but I attend all the messages. And I'm very happy of having the chance and the opportunity to share a little bit of my life and experiences with you guys. I'm honored and thankful for the opportunity. And I would say, you know, as a last thing for the people and the coaches that might hear this, as a little piece of advice, that you know, you have to reflect and review what you do, what you are. Seeing it like viewing yourself in a mirror from a coaching distance, and that's what helped me a lot in the past few years. That what helped me a lot when I was a player, and that will be my last piece of advice. Hopefully, people can excuse my poor English skills, and I hope they understand enough of what I said. But anyone wanted to reach out, I would be more than glad to get back to them.
That would be awesome. I don't think people are going to have any trouble understanding. You brought just a tremendous amount of knowledge. I love that last piece of advice about being self-aware. I think if you can be self-aware, it gives you an opportunity to become a learner, to understand what you don't know, and to be able to grow as a coach. And we hope that all the coaches that are out there listening in our audience, that you take the time to reflect on some of the things that Oscar shared with us tonight. I think there was tremendous value there. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.